And tonight we're talking Soul Survivor, the reincarnation of a World War II fighter pilot, the incredible story of James Leininger. We'll be back with his parents, Bruce and Andrea, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Bruce or Andrea, when little James said little man can't get out, when he was talking about plane on fire, what did he mean by that?
Well, you have to remember he was just a few months past his second birthday. I think he was trying to articulate himself with, you know, what words he had in his vocabulary. You have children, you know,
yeah,
that when they're first learning to speak, you know, they're trying to communicate the best way we can. When I used to think back on it after the fact, several years or once we had finally gotten through this entire journey, I almost felt like what he was trying to describe was what he was seeing, like an out-of-body experience, like his spirit was leaving his body and he was looking down, watching himself struggling in the plane.
Right.
That's actually how I interpreted what he was saying. Many years after the fact, initially I just thought, I didn't know what to think. I was so mind-boggled by that coming out of my two-year-old's mouth.
Did he ever describe what happened to the plane and what happened to him, how he was shot down?
Well, one time, yeah. I think one thing that didn't make it into the book, and he said it so matter-of-factly, and he only said it the one time that I was washing dishes in the morning and he was playing in the sunroom and I was looking out the window watching him, and the window, you know, it's open. It's an addition to the house. It used to be a patio, but now it's an enclosed sunroom and the kitchen window looks out onto it. And he was playing with a plane. He was just flying it back and forth, you know, like a two-year-old does. And he just said, "Mama, before I was born, I was a pilot and my airplane got shot in the engine and crashed in the water. And that's how I died."
And when I came home from work that day and she told me that, I sat down with him and I grabbed one of his models or one of his toys and I said, "Okay, can you tell me where your plane was hit?" And he pointed directly right at the nub where the propeller is attached, you know, right at the very front of the engine.
Mm-hmm. And hence, that could explain why he takes propellers off all the planes that he has.
Well, yeah.
Could be.
Because the coincidence, it's not a coincidence, but only single engine fighters lost their propellers. His dual engine aircraft models, like a P-38 Lightning or some of the other things that he had, they kept their propellers. But all the single engine fighters, they all lost their propellers.
Bruce, when I remember reading on this story years ago, didn't he also know something about the Corsair's tires? They would blow out sometimes upon impact.
Yeah, at one point when we were going to get ready to shoot a pilot that eventually turned into the ABC Prime timepiece, the lady was here doing kind of pre-work to make sure we didn't, you know, we were real and that there was enough to really do something. And we got a book out that had a Corsair in it.
Well, actually, Shalini asked James, she was interviewing James, and she said, "Can you show me a picture of a Corsair?" And by that time, Bruce had begun his research.
Sure.
He'd been researching for about a year at this point. So we had, you know, several military books in the house, and James went and got a book that had World War II aircraft in it, and he brought it over to the table and flipped through, and he got to the Corsair, and he pointed to it. He said, "That's a Corsair." And he started laughing. He goes, "You know what? They used to get flat tires all the time, and they always wanted to turn to the left." But the thing that surprised me was he was four. He didn't know left from right yet.
The whole thing is just fascinating. It really is. Tell me about James Houston. What do we know about him?
Bruce, you want to answer that?
Sure. Well, he was born in October 1922. He had an avid interest in shooting and in
as sports. James has now.
Yeah. And a very good shot, by the way. According to Bob Greenwalt, Houston was the best shot in their Corsair squadron that they were both in together before they got to VC-81 together on Natoma Bay. He liked athletics. He was passionate about flying airplanes. He belonged to the Lower Marion Bulldog Flying Club when he was in high school. he had model gas-driven planes, and as soon as he could get into a program after a year, I think he went to was a college, a junior college or something close by Bryn Mawr. He then went into the Navy and went qualified for flight in the ground school, and then from there he became a pilot. He was very polite, very proper, didn't like to drink at all, didn't like cursing. He had musical talent. You know, earlier, James is just not interested in shooting guns. He loves to play the guitar. He's got a great little voice, and James Houston loved singing. He actually had a recording of a song that he did, Red Sails in the Sunset, which is kind of a prophetic kind of a little song if you look at the words. You know, Jim Houston was a really fine man.
And he was left-handed, and our son was left-handed.
That's something, too. Tell me about the mission where James Houston was shot down, Bruce.
On that day, it was the last scheduled mission for BC-81. And they were going to do an attack with TBMs or Avengers from Sergeant Bay, eight fighters from Natoma Bay, and eight TBMs from Sergeant Bay. And they flew about 200 miles to Chichijima to strafe the harbor there that had ships in it. The Americans were always concerned about the resupply of troops at Iwo Jima, and Chichijima could have been a staging area along with those other islands in that group. And so they flew up there to strafe the ships and fire rockets at the ships. And on that day, the eight fighters from Natoma Bay flew in first to strafe. Houston was the tail end Charlie, and he flew in almost adjacent to an echelon of TBMs from Sergeant Bay. And in that attack, that first run on the island is when his plane was hit and hit right in the engine. We found four eyewitnesses after about a year and a half of searching for the guys from BC-83 that I interviewed, and they all were able to verify the exact details of how our son always told us his plane had been shot down.
Did he to date ever recall, and I don't want to get too graphic here, but and that's one thing I didn't want to ask him when I was talking to him, Bruce, but did he recollect the actual crash?
Well, he just, what he said, and you might be able to answer this, Andrew, but what he said was that his airplane got shot in the engine and it crashed in the water and the little man couldn't get out. And the airplane was on fire, which is exactly what
happened.
The eyewitnesses described. He never really said anything else other than that. But he did say that several times.
He said that practically every time he had the nightmare. Once he got a little more verbal, initially he was crying out and jibber-jabbering in his sleep when he first had the nightmare. But, you know, he started having the nightmares 2 weeks after his second birthday. You know, he was still trying to, you know, get his, you know, he's still learning verbal skills. So it wasn't until a few months later that I was able to discern. I went to his room, and all of a sudden I just heard it finally made sense what he was saying. And then after that, it became clearer and clearer and clearer. But when you looked at him having the nightmare, it looked like somebody who was trapped in something and they were trying to kick their way out of it. It was very disturbing.
He was thrashing around under the covers like he was just, he literally fighting for his life. The first time I saw it, my immediate thought was the scenes from The Exorcist where the girl's just flopping around in bed like somebody hit her with an electric, you know, with a high voltage electric.
But it wasn't just flopping around.
No.
He was laying in bed.
No, he was fighting.
But he was always lying on his back, kicking his feet up. He would kick his feet up at the ceiling and kick and kick like if you were trying to get out of a box.
But it was a flailing kind of thing. You know, it was really graphic looking.
It sounds like Houston may have been alive when he hit.
Oh, absolutely. That's the conclusion that we came to. I mean, we can't verify that physically at this point, but, you know, my conclusion is that he was still alive in that plane when it hit the water, even though it was on fire. And he was trying to, he was fighting his way. He was fighting to get himself out of that plane.
Well, and according to the eyewitnesses, what happened was when the plane was hitting the engine, there was this instantaneous giant flash of flame. The plane didn't disintegrate at all. And at that point, it was just like a, almost like an explosion. It just didn't continue to flame, although it probably was on fire, but it wasn't this flaming ball that went into the ocean.
Did they ever find the plane? Did they ever find James Houston's body?
Well, first of all, we know where the plane is located. We were out. We had a diagram from the mission that was drawn after it, and I verified with the four eyewitnesses that the plane crashed in the area marked on the diagram. No one's ever dove on the spot.
Okay.
There's no reason to believe that the plane isn't there because it would have never been salvaged. When we went to the island, the island historian indicated that no one ever knew that there was a plane there. There were three planes in the harbor, but they were all in shallower water where they could be dove onto. One was a Japanese float plane, and the other two were U.S. Navy aircraft that had been shot down attacking the island.
If they ever found the remains of James Houston, the dog tags as well, and, they performed the appropriate service for that, would you bring James there?
Annie does not want the remains disturbed. She thinks that James Houston's final resting place is beautiful, and that's where she wants her
wants him to stay.
And if that's what she wants, then I support that. It's not my place to move them or have them. She's still alive, and if that's what she wanted, it's her family member. Then she would do that, but she doesn't want to. So,
and I have no wish or desire to disturb the body. The U.S. military, if they know where there are remains, they will work to recover them. But this would not be an easy thing to do because the water in the harbor where the plane rests is somewhere deeper than 300 feet. It's fairly precipitous.
So I've always believed that when a person dies, unless they've reached this level of perfection,
right,
call it heaven, if they don't reach that, they come back. They come back and they get better. They perfect each life.
Yep.
In each life, they're supposed to get better. I assume that with this case, James Houston came back. His soul had to come back to continue growing.
Yep.
And, I
agree. Yeah. Yeah, when we get into that point, we get into conjecture based upon our faith and where we are in our own journey about our faith and our spirits. It's impossible to understand exactly what's happening. James says he went to heaven and God let him come back or picked him to come back.
Yeah.
I remember at the time when
one that knows.
When at the time we were able to have these little brief snippets of discussion with him, and this came shortly after. Well, it came right around the time of the revelation with the three G.I. Joes.
Right.
And he had said that's who met him when he got to heaven.
Yeah.
And a few weeks after he told us that, I was talking to him, and he said something that led me to believe that was an opening, that it was one of those brief moments where I could ask a few questions and I may get a few answers. And I asked him, I said, do you remember going to heaven? And he said, yes. And I said, well, do you have to come back? Does everybody come back? And he said, no, you get to choose. If you don't want to come back, you don't have to. But if you decide you want to, you can come back. And I said, is there really a heaven? And he said, yes. And I said, is there really a God? And he said, yes.
That
and
amazing.
I thought, okay, here's my chance to ask the question that everyone's wanted to know. I said, is God a man or a woman?
Did you really?
Yes.
And what was the answer?
He said, he's not a man or a woman. He's whoever you need him to be at the time.
Right answer, I think.
And he was four.
Right.
How do you feel, Andrea, you as a mother, that, this is happening to your little boy? I mean, do you feel like you were losing him, or do you feel like you may have gained a friend with James Houston?
I feel like I gained a friend with James Houston. I feel like James Houston came back for a reason. Our job as his parents was not to ignore what he was going through, but it was to try and help figure out what did James Houston come back for. You know, I don't want James to remember this. We didn't openly discuss it. We still don't openly discuss it in our family. Bruce and I try, and whenever we have a conversation about it, we try and make sure it's when James is asleep or he's not here. We have never openly discussed it in front of him, especially when he was having the nightmares. But I felt like there was something we were supposed to do. I didn't know what it was, and we discussed that so many times. Why is he remembering this? Are we supposed to do something? Is he, you know, is his spirit unresolved? Was his death so traumatic that he's going to carry this with him forever and ever? And I just wanted James to find peace. I wanted him to find closure. Right. I wanted us to do whatever, or James to do whatever, was part of his spiritual journey to help put this behind him, resolve the conflict for James Houston, and move forward with his own life. I don't want James to remember his past life. He has a life. He's James Leininger, and he's got to go on to fulfill whatever mission he came here to fulfill. But in the process of going through this whole journey and uncovering it, I found that the surprising consequences of that was that so many people, the 21 men from the Natoma Bay, we have not found all the families, but we found about 15 of them, and none of those families knew what happened to their loved ones. They were as much in the dark as James Houston's family.
Right, and they want answers.
They wanted to know. I mean, it used to be that you would get a yellow telegram, your loved one was dead, and the military was sorry, and that's about all you knew.
Right.
You know, the records were classified. They were unavavailable. No family members were able to figure out what really happened to their loved ones. They were just dead.
And there were really pretty dramatic points of healing with John Richardson, the eyewitness that was looking at Houston, and Houston was looking at him when Houston's plane was hit. John never knew who that man was, but that face haunted him for 60 years. And when I went to visit him, he said, I've never known who he was. He says, his face has haunted me my whole life. Now I know who he is. And he broke down. He started to cry. So I saw a healing take place there, because this terrorizing mystery of seeing someone die in front of him was ended. And then he wound up speaking to Ann Barron about a week or two later, and I spoke with Ann afterwards, and she said it was such a relief to talk to John, because now I know that Jimmy didn't suffer. He's resting in such a beautiful place. I wish my father would have known this before he died.
Yeah.
And Richardson died about 4 or 5 months later.
Little James, he's 11 years old. That puts him, what, fifth, sixth grade?
Yeah, he just finished fifth grade.
Just finished fifth. And do his friends talk to him about this? You know the way kids can be.
Yeah, you know, it's really strange. A lot of the kids have not made fun of him or teased him in any way. I think the only thing that came up is James mentioned at the beginning of the year that he was going to be in a book, and a few of the kids said he was lying. And then at the end of the year, when the book was getting ready to come out, my husband went to the school. James goes to a private Episcopal school, and he always has. So he goes to chapel 5 days a week, and, you know, he understands quite a bit about religion. But Bruce went after chapel to give a discussion for the whole fifth grade class, and he had a copy of the book, and James was just happy that the kids knew that he wasn't lying, and a few of those kids were like, oh, my gosh, you were telling the truth.
Yeah, their mouths open. You know.
But mostly what the kids said is, oh, my gosh, we saw you on Good Morning America or something like that. They just thought it was cool that he was on TV, and then that was pretty much the end of it, and then they'd go play on the jungle gym at school.
And be kids again.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the remarkable thing of all this. He's just a kid.
He's just a kid.
Yeah, he's just a regular. He's an 11-year-old kid. He likes to play the guitar. He likes to play in the backyard. We'll go target shooting every once in a while. We go to the pool. He's now starting to work out at the gym a little bit because he's getting the children's gym.
That's great. Well, when we come back, I want to talk about what it was like for little James to meet Jack Larson and to also meet the family of James Houston. That's next. Well, next hour, our final hour, we'll take phone calls with Bruce and Andrea Leininger about this incredible story, Soul Survivor. When we come back, though, more to talk about on Coast to Coast AM. Bruce, tell us a little bit more about Jack Larson.
Okay. Well, at the beginning, when I got the name Larson, I started to try to figure out how I was going to find him, and discovered that there, because I thought I was looking for Jack. Andrea thinks that it was always James, but I was looking for Jack as the dead guy.
I know we thought about that for years.
And found 170 people that were listed in the American Battle Monuments Commission that were either buried overseas or missing in action that had the last name Larson in two variations, S-O-N or S-E-N. And then we couldn't find anything about him, really. You know, I had no way of knowing which 170 of them there were. A couple of people were tantalizing. I wrote to the archives, couldn't get anything back because I wasn't a family member at that point, although their rules have apparently changed recently. And then I went to the reunion, and, you know, I met John DeWitt at the reunion, who was one of the four guys that I tried to call. And he said, well, you know, I know Jack's name. I think he's on our roster. And so within a half hour of being at the reunion, I found out that Jack Larson was alive and well and living in Farmingdale, Arkansas. That night I called him. I couldn't believe it. You know, what does he have to do with this? He's alive. He's supposed to be dead. And so I called Jack up, and, you know, I told him the same thing. You know, he was a fighter pilot. He was the only one I knew of that was alive at that point. So I called him, and then I went up to see him 2 weeks later. He was really an endearing, nice man, his great, nice wife, Dorothy. And I thought when I was driving up there, he got some subliminal connection to this. What is it? What is it? You know, does he feel something? Can he feel something about this? And so I went up to visit him, and we described that mission that day. That was when I found out that he was alive and well, and not just did he know about what happened in terms of the mission that day, but he flew that mission. He never saw what happened to Houston because he described Houston as the tail end Charlie. And then the morning I was there, I stayed there overnight, and I was telling him about James, and he said, well, just wait a second. And he got up from the table in the kitchen and turned around, went out into the garage, came back with his dusty old cloth sack. He pulled out this helmet. He said, here, I wore this on the day that Houston was killed. This was what I wore as my helmet. And he gave it to me, and I said, what did he do that for?
Yeah.
You know, I was still mystified by it. And Jack has become a good friend, you know. When we told him exactly why this had happened, he had a hard time with it. He had to go talk to his priest. I remember Dorothy on the phone that night going, oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. And but he and James got along famously at the reunion when we went to the reunion in 2004.
How strange, wasn't it?
It was like a pal. He was hanging around. He went to breakfast with these pilots. There's this.
Did they like having him around?
Oh yeah, they loved it. Why don't you tell them about Bob Greenwald, honey?
Oh well, when we went to the reunion, I was just always flabbergasted that there. I remember saying, I can't believe that there really is a Jack Larson. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the aircraft action report, when Bruce went to that reunion and was able to find, not only did he find out that Jack Larson was alive, but he was able to. You know, eventually that led to him getting the aircraft action report from the mission that day, and it has the diagram of how the planes are flying in, and they're coming in an echelon, which is sort of like a diagonal line. And James Houston was at the very last person, so everybody else from his squadron on that mission would not have seen him because they were all ahead of him. But the person in the plane right ahead of him was Jack Larson.
Right.
Jeez.
But we're at the reunion, and James saw Jack, and he just went up, and he had this flight suit on, and gave him a big handshake, and he was just so happy to see him. And we have a picture of him sitting with Jack, and right as soon as we met, I said, let me get your picture. So James went and sat next to him, and he's just like a buddy. It was really cute.
And that's the picture that's in the book.
Did Jack feel strange? Did he feel kind of mystical, I guess, being around little James?
I'm sure he didn't know what to think. I mean, he was he was very gracious. He was very nice. You know, he was really sweet with James. But I'm sure he was thinking, oh, my Lord.
Yeah. What's going on here?
Right.
But later on that same day, you know, James was just a little boy. He had, I think it was in second grade. So we kept going up to the room because I had homework to do with him, and I had to take him to the pool. I didn't want him to be too immersed in the whole thing. I really wanted him to just have a little bit of time there with the men, and then I wanted him to go be a second grader.
Sure.
I just wanted him to have little bits and pieces of this. I didn't want it to be too overwhelming. So at one point, we'd come back down to they called it the ready room, where all the guys hung out, and we came down to see what Bruce was doing and just catch up, and then we were walking out to go back up to the room to do homework, and this man walked up to James. He was a robust-looking older gentleman. He was tan and in great shape and had a golf shirt on, and he saw us, and I'd never seen the man before. I didn't know who it was, and he just bent over to James, and he looked at him, and he goes, "Do you know who I am?" And James looked at him for a second, and he goes, "You're Bob Greenwald." And the man goes, "That's right." And I'm like, "You are? You're Bob Greenwald?" And I said, "How did you know that?" And James goes, "I recognized his voice."
That is cool. Yeah. That is unbelievable.
Amazing.
Now, at what point did you introduce James to the family of Houston? And how did that even happen?
It was at the reunion, that same reunion where he met Jack and Bob Greenwald. It was probably the most highly attended reunion that the Natoma Bay has had, and probably since like the 50s.
Right. I mean, did they know little James was coming?
Yes.
Okay.
We knew that they were going to meet. Annie and her daughter Leslie, you know, had planned to come. We were doing Bruce found out pretty early on there was only one memorial for the Natoma Bay, the men who'd been lost on Natoma Bay, and it's on the Yorktown in Charleston, South Carolina. It's the only memorial. But he found three of the men's names were left off. They're not on the memorial. So we wanted to do a new memorial and rededicate it. And we invited all the families of all the 21 men who had been lost. Many of them came, and many of the pilots who had served with James Houston came. Of course, by this time, the story was out. The primetime piece had already aired. Everybody knew, the cat was out of the bag, so to speak. So we had the memorial service, and Ann Barron, Houston Barron, and her daughter Leslie came up, and I was trying to orchestrate it so that it wouldn't be this overwhelming thing. I wanted to have a little bit of control over when sure. and how they met, but that ended up not happening. We ended up running into each other in the hallway at the hotel, and it was just kind of strange. I could see James just looking at Annie. And, you know, it was very formal. And
Annie would have been his sister?
Yeah, Annie was James Houston's sister.
Yeah.
But it was like James just kept looking to try and see Annie as she was. He remembered her as a 24-year-old,
yeah.
And now she was, you know, getting close to 90.
So that must have been a little confusing for him.
It was. It was confusing for him, but he just kept staring at her and staring at her and didn't really know what to say. And then we went out to dinner that night, and he kind of warmed up with Annie and started talking to her, and they really hit it off. You know, he thinks of her at the time, you know, I'm not sure how he thinks now. I haven't asked him for a while, but at the time he would always, I'd say, well, who's Annie? And he's like, oh, that's my sister.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time where James cried, got upset over all of this? The fact that he is a reincarnated World War II fighter pilot?
Well,
yeah, there has been times. You know, one time was when we were going to go on to Good Morning America. It was after the primetime piece, and they were sort of doing a revisiting it.
Right.
And doing an update. And they wanted to talk to him on TV about it and interview him. And we said, well, that's up to you, James. You know, if that's something that you're comfortable with, that's fine. And that's still what we say to him. It's up to him. It's his life. And if he wants to talk about it, that's his choosing. I leave that up to him to decide. And he's opened up to discussing it, but at the time he got very upset and said, I really don't want to talk about it. It makes me sad.
Yeah, when I think about it, because I told him that, you know, he might be asked some questions, and I wanted him to know that he may be asked some questions on TV, and it wasn't like it was being taped. And he got really angry. He turned his back, got really negative. I could tell he started to cry.
Hmm.
And I got him to turn around, come over and sit on my lap. And I said, what's the matter, buddy? Come on. You know, I'm just doing this to tell you what might happen. If you don't want to talk to somebody, you don't have to. He said, it just makes me really sad when I think about it.
Most of the time, is he little James Leininger?
He's our son, James. He's right. A typical 11-year-old. He throws his clothes on the floor, not in the hamper. He doesn't put his dish in the dishwasher. He hates doing homework. You know, he's just a typical 11-year-old.
That's right.
But, you know, a part of me truly, if we ask James or anybody else ask James if he remembers it, if he remembers the nightmares, he always says no. But some part of me, I'm really convinced that he does remember some things, and he just, he says no because he doesn't want to talk about it.
Maybe it hurts.
And it hurts. And the finish of that conversation when we were getting ready to go up to Good Morning America the first time, he said, well, I'll talk about it when I'm older. And I said, well, you do whatever you want, and our job is to help you. Another thing he did was at the reunion where has he ever gotten sad? We were at the pool taking a break, and he looked troubled about something, you know. He wasn't upset, but he just looked troubled, like there was something on his mind. And so we're swimming around in the pool. I said, James, you okay? You know, it looks like you have something that's bothering you. He said, everyone is so old. Now, you know, and everyone was so old. But what he was trying to articulate was, the last time I saw all these people, they were young, you know.
Really was like he was so excited to go to the reunion and see everybody again. But I never anticipated this, he expected them to look like they did last time he saw them.
He thought
they were all going to be 20 years old.
And I'm not, you know, he never talked about it. You know, when we've gone to do things like that, you know, we've never really sat down, well, here's what we're going to be doing, and here's how we're going to be doing this and doing that. You know, we will try to explain what's going to happen, but we don't sit and discuss it at all. We don't sit and say, well, you know, here's what you're going to do, and here's how you're going to do it. It was like when he got on the radio with you earlier this evening, I said, James, okay, just tell people what you remember. You know, don't make up anything. If you don't remember something or
ask
you a question you can't answer, then don't answer. Just tell them you don't know.
I wish some politicians would act that way, Bruce.
Well, they need better coaches.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's the only preparation we do with James. You know, if we're going to do one of these things, you know, I'm anxious to hear if he remembers anything. And every once in a while, he'll come out with a little snippet of something. And only in the last few weeks have I come to the conclusion that he does remember something, and it's just not something he wants to discuss.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's perfectly fine with me. It's his life, and if at some point he wants to tell his own story, he can do that. If he doesn't, that's fine with me too. But it's, you know, I'm not going to probe him, or I'm not going to make him do something that he's not comfortable with. You know, he has to make those decisions for himself, and I respect that.
Then he says some pretty profound things, just like he told you tonight. Well, you know, here's how it happened. You know, God let me come back.
Yeah,
God told me I could come back. One night, I think he was probably seven, and it was on my birthday, and I'd come home from work and had a pretty particularly cruddy day at work. You know, this is nothing, one of those days where nothing went right, and we're walking around out in the neighborhood, take a little walk before we had dinner, and I was talking to him about it. And he looked at me, and he goes, well, Dad, he says, you know, every day is like a carrier landing. If you can walk away from it, you're okay.
Jeez.
Now, you know.
What great wisdom.
7-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You know, where does that come from? You know, that doesn't come out of, even if you watch A&E 24 hours a day, that doesn't come out of
no,
A&E.
It doesn't.
You know,
and that is where he's got a maturity level about him.
Yeah.
That has got to be. He's 11 going on what, 35?
Something yeah. like that.
He's 11 going on something.
Yeah.
He was baffled. Someone was asking him a question in an interview. Well, if you came back, who would you be? And he was stumped. And so next morning, and this is just a few weeks ago, we're sitting there talking. I said, James, here was the answer to that question. He said, you've already been there and done that.
Yeah.
And he kind of grinned at me, you know, he didn't say it, but it was like, you know, that's what I should have said.
With the website you've set up here, are you also, you know, helping other people who are going through probably some similar things here?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been one of the most intriguing things about this. One thing, and I'm a private person, you know, Bruce and I were laughing earlier about, you know, how vastly different we are, because he'll talk about this until the cows come home and he'll stop, you know, he loves the story now he does, but you know, he loves to discuss it. He loves to get into the whole thing. And I'm much more private. I like to go about my life, and, you know, friends who've known me forever were probably really surprised by the book because, you know, they may not have ever heard the story before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we both approached this from such a different perspective that I think that's one thing that just we really balance each other with our different point of views.
But on the website, you know, which is soulsurvivor-book.com, there is a place on the where we're asking people to share their experiences because we believe that this happens more frequently than people think, and we're getting feedback that's pretty startling.
It really is. And what is this for you, Bruce, who started off as a skeptic?
Right.
What does this tell you now about what could be on the other side?
Well, it is added a depth to my Christian faith and belief system.
And it doesn't negate it, does it?
No. What it does is, you know, my analogy is my faith up until this point where I was really tested by this. You know, I had a really difficult time. I did a lot of praying. I talked to a minister. You know, what am I going through? What's happening in my house? The world was flat, and now it's a sphere.
How about you, Andrea?
It has really just reinforced my faith. You know, reincarnation is not something I believed or disbelieved before. It wasn't really something I ever took the time to contemplate. But now that I have gone through this experience with my son, it just has enriched and reaffirmed my religious faith. I was talking to my sister earlier tonight and asking her, do you ever remember hearing ever in church that reincarnation was something that is against our religion, that we should not believe in it? And it never was. You know, it's not counter to anything that I was taught in church or in Sunday school. You know, it doesn't go against my religious faith. It just has affirmed it. And it's funny, in an interview the other night, an interviewer asked James if he believed in reincarnation, and he said, "Well, you know what? I go to chapel 5 days a week, and every single day, I pray that Jesus Christ will come again to judge the living and the dead." He said, "I say that every single day in chapel. I say it at church on Sunday," and he said, "I do believe Jesus will come back, but if Jesus does come back, do you think he's just going to show up like in Star Trek? He's just going to beam in like he left? Or do you think he'll have to be reborn again?" He said, if he had to get born from the Virgin Mary the first time, why would God have gone to all that trouble if he could just make him show up?
Good point. You know, they say as children become adults, they tend to forget
right.
all these incredible supernatural events of their early life.
Right.
If James Bruce forgets, mm-hmm. are you going to remind him or just let it go?
Well, the book is there, you know, in terms of him, our goal and our mission in terms of being parents, if there's a mission to being parents, is he's our son. We want him to be whatever he wants to be. We want him to be as happy as he can ever imagine to be, as fulfilled as we can help him get there. And So we feel about James just as every parent should feel about their children.
Let's come back and take final phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.